Well, good evening. My name is Nick Caldry. I'm the head of LSE's Department of Media and Communications. And I'm delighted to welcome you this evening to our autumn public lecture with a distinguished expert on strategic communications, Professor Jim McNamara. Following directly after his lecture, we have two distinguished commentators. Stephen Coleman is Professor of Political Communications at University of Leeds. And Professor Sandra Jovcelovic is in the Department of Social Psychology, Psychological and Behavioural Sciences, as it now is, or Social Psychology as it was, at LSE. Jim is going to talk for around 45 minutes, and then our two commentators will talk for around 10 minutes each, and then we'll leave around 20, 25 minutes for questions, and I'm sure there will be many questions. Before I hand over to Jim, though, let me first say something about his really remarkable career. Jim McNamara is Professor of Public Communication and Associate Dean in the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Technology, Sydney. We're also pleased that currently he's a visiting professor in the Department of Media and Communications at LSE. And he's one of those remarkable people who has had not just one, but two successful careers. First as a journalist and strategic communications professional, running his own consultancy, and most recently as an academic. As an academic, frankly, his productivity rivals that of people who've been academics throughout their single career. He's the author of 5 books, including 4 in the last 6 years, with his important 2010 book, The 21st Century Media Revolution, now being in its second edition. Other notable titles are Public Relations, Theories, Practices, Critiques from 2012, Journalism and PR, Unpacking Spin from 2014, and crucially for this talk, Organizational Listening from 2016, and there will be signed copies of that book in the lobby outside. And he also has a new book coming out next year, Evaluating Public Communication, Exploring New Models, Standards, and Best Practice. And on top of all that, Jim is conducting, in my view, some of the boldest empirical field work going on in organizations anywhere in the world today about how organizations communicate or perhaps don't communicate, about how they try to listen and consult and whether they succeed in doing so, and if not, why not, and with what consequences for their own legitimacy and stability as institutions, and of course for the wider public culture and for our possibilities of something like a democratic life. His current fieldwork is being conducted in close collaboration with the UK government, working in a number of departments, as he will describe, in what would be an understatement to say is now an interesting moment for British and world politics and the possibility of government. Never, it seems, has there been more at stake in knowing whether and how governments can listen and whether they really want to. Now let us welcome Jim McNamara for his lecture on the lost art of listening. Jim.
Thank you, Nick. Good evening, colleagues, distinguished guests and students. Almost a decade ago, or a decade before the very now equally famous and infamous EU referendum, almost a decade before the election of Donald Trump as president-elect of the United States, Les Back warned in a book about the lost art of listening in affecting contemporary societies. Now, whether listening is a lost art or not, I'm not sure. A loss of listening, for example, presupposes a golden age of listening. But we know that golden ages are mostly mythical, based on our nostalgia and often wishfulness. But what we do know is 2 things. First, listening is essential in our lives. We crave to be listened to as individuals. In democracies, we have a right to be listened to. We also know that we need to listen to others, whether it's our parents, at school, at work, at university, to know what is happening in the world and to function in the world. I'll give you a very simple experiment before I conclude this evening that will demonstrate just how essential listening is in our relationships in our daily lives. But the second thing we know from research that I'll talk about this evening is that listening is in short supply in many spheres of society. Now, I'm not here this evening to talk about the UK referendum or the election of Donald Trump, but I do believe that those events were influenced by a lack of listening by major organisations and major institutions in our society. It could be said that there's a crisis of listening, and I recognise that the word crisis is often overused, but I will try to justify that title this evening. But in particular, I want to talk today, this evening, about organisations, listening in and on behalf of organisations, because today we live in industrialised and post-industrial societies, what Nick Cawdrey calls complex societies. As Bruce Bimber and colleagues note, in such societies, organisations such as government departments and agencies, corporations, non-government organisations and various non-profits play a central role and affect almost every aspect of people's lives. From the national government and huge corporations, which we depend on for services such as health and internet and phone connectivity, to local businesses, hospitals, schools, clubs, fire brigades and so on, people have to interact with these organisations on a daily basis. Now, listening is important and at times challenging, even on a one-on-one basis and in small groups. I'm sure many of us are reminded of that in our family lives from time to time. But organisational listening faces some special challenges. I'm using the term organisational listening, I might say, that I'm not trying to anthropomorphise organisations. Even though listening ultimately is done by humans in organisations, organisations need to be able to engage in large-scale listening, often to thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands, and in the case of national government, sometimes millions of people. Whether they are members, patients, students, customers, citizens, and so on. Also, listening in organisations is distributed and delegated to various functions and units that we'll talk about. Therefore, organisational listening is very much shaped by systemic and institutional factors, including culture, structures, policies, processes, and technologies, as well as human factors. But whereas listening receives close attention in interpersonal communication and fields such as psychology and leadership, there's actually been relatively little study of how, to what extent, and even whether organisations that we depend on, including organisations that are established to serve us, whether they're able to listen and whether they do. Now, the importance of listening in at a social, cultural, political and commercial level is well established in a substantial body of research literature that I'll only briefly refer to. John Dewey said society exists in communication, by which, of course, he means that the coming together and functioning of groups of people as communities or businesses or organisation is impossible without communication. James Carey notes the importance of conversations in society, and as both describe communication as the organising element of human society. But what about listening specifically? Well, most of us know that talking, as much as we like to do it, does not on its own constitute communication. And hopefully, if you're studying communication, you will learn that. Communication is about dialogue. Communication is a two-way process. Hans-Georg Gadamer refers to communication needs an openness to the other. As Leslie Baxter warns more recently, dialogue is not simply turn-taking and speaking. Communication is transactional, not transmissional. In short, communication must involve speaking and listening. In fact, the eminent US communications scholar Robert Craig defines listening as speaking or talking and listening. Similarly, Nick Cawdrey, who inspired some of the research that I will talk about this evening, says that what we call voice, particularly voice that matters, is the implicitly linked practices of speaking and listening. In a democracy, in particular, vox populi, the voice of the people, is the basis of legitimacy and of policy. It is actually explicit in democratic political theory that politicians and governments listen to the people. Following on from Stephen Coleman's 2012 book, How Voters Feel, Andrew Dobson's 2014 book, Listening for Democracy, gave us one of the first signs that maybe part of the malaise in Western democracies might be something to do with listening. And recently, of course, governments in many countries have launched initiatives variously called open government, open policy, and new age terms such as Gov 2.0, emphasising allegedly openness and two-way communication. Governments and commercial organisations today profess to want engagement with those and relationships with those who they call their stakeholders. In fact, engagement has been labelled one of the buzzwords of the decade. But how do we achieve public communication, voice that matters, two-way interaction, open government, open policy, engagement, relationships, and even democracy itself? How do we achieve those if listening is done poorly, or sometimes not at all, by the organisations that represent us and govern us? Before I address that question, I need to define what I mean by listening. Because if we expect too much of listening, and we place unrealistic expectations on listening, it is bound to fall short. On the other hand, tokenistic efforts and various forms of pseudo or pretend listening will not meet the requirements of communication, of social and democratic theory or political theory, or indeed the reasonable expectations of those that neoliberalism likes to call consumers, but who might be more respectfully referred to as customers or students or members or patients or indeed citizens. In my book on organisational listening published earlier this year, I identify what I call seven canons of listening, drawing on communication studies, sociology, psychology and ethics, including the work of a number of authors such as Susan Bickford, Axel Honneth, Charles Husband, Sarah Lunstein, Roger Silverstone and others. From that, to me, I believe an open, ethical and effective approach to listening should involve these seven elements. Firstly, recognition of others as having a right to speak and deciding who we listen to. Secondly, something we learned from the 2008 Obama presidential campaigns is the importance of acknowledgement, of acknowledging expressions of voice, whether they are letters, emails, submissions, and so forth. And I'll return to some of these principles later in terms of how well we actually address them. Of course, in listening, we must pay attention to others. We need to interpret what is said as fairly and accurately and honestly as possible, recognising that people are not always able to articulately express their views. We need to do that interpretation in order to try and gain an understanding of others, something that was very relevant to the EU referendum, perhaps, and the people of Britain, as well as the United States. We need to then very seriously give consideration to what is heard, and finally, respond in some appropriate way. And you'll notice there that agreement is not necessarily part of those seven canons. Funnily enough, people generally do not expect agreement. In fact, the expectations of the public are actually low, according to research. One recent study by Ipsos Mori found that 70% of UK citizens do not believe the national government listens to them or will take any notice of what they say. Against that backdrop, in 2014, I set out, as Nick said, on a two-year, three-country study of organisational listening. I was intrigued to see how organisations go about this important process. I will just briefly explain the methodology of the study to give you a sense of the depth and therefore the legitimacy of the findings. The Organisational Listening Project Stage 1 involved analysis of 36 case studies, 18 government departments and agencies, 14 corporations, and four non-government organisations in Australia, the UK and the US. And you might recognise a few small organisations in those photos. The one on the right-hand side is me on a very freezing New York day at minus 17. Now, in these organisations, I had to recognise that listening, of course, occurs in multiple sites. So I looked at up to eight functions in these organisations where listening might potentially occur. Research, often referred to as insights, but I looked at corporate communication and public relations, if it existed, government communication, internal communication in organisations, customer relations, public consultation, very importantly, social media and correspondence. So there are other places where organisations listen, but these were eight of the more important and obvious functions where listening, if it's going to occur, could occur. All of the organisations were studied in their natural setting over a period of several days and often several weeks in many cases, using triangulation of three research methods. Firstly, I interviewed the heads of the various functions that involve communication that I've just listed. Up to 7 interviews were conducted in many organisations and generated 1,000 pages of transcripts that were analysed in detail using InVivo. But conscious of what, and those who do research methods in the room, I hope you'd recognise that interviews are self-reporting. And so to try and validate that data, I also wanted to get access to documents that I could analyse, and I did content analysis of a number of communication, consultation, research plans and reports. For example, if an organisation claimed to have done public consultation, I needed to see the report and plans, particularly the report of the consultation, to validate the claims. The third thing we did with the research associates is a number of field tests were conducted with real-life inquiries, comments requiring a response, and in a few cases, genuine complaints that were submitted to the organisations we were studying, and we tracked their actual response. The first and last questions asked of organisations really tell the story. Firstly, despite gaining introductions to organisations through trusted third parties or having a personal contact, 20% of the organisations I contacted did not respond in any way, not the 36. I contacted more than 80 to get the 36. The last question asked of participating organisations was their confirmation or challenge to my estimate, based on my interviews and observation and document analysis, of the percentage of their resources and time that was devoted to distributing the organisation's messages, i.e. speaking, compared with the resources and time devoted to some form of listening to stakeholders and publics. The organisation study agreed that on average 80% of their communicative efforts were focused on distributing the organisation's messages, that is, speaking. In fact, in some cases, up to 95% of communicative efforts, budgets and resources of organisations was involved in distributing their messages to audiences. Furthermore, when organisations do listen, the study found a predominant focus on instrumental listening. By that I mean listening is undertaken mainly to achieve the objectives of the organisation. For example, research and public consultation most typically seeks answers to the questions that the organisation wants to ask. Research is also mainly undertaken to gain information that helps the organisation target potential customers and citizens with messages and products. Customer relations is mainly undertaken for pacification in the case of aggravated instances, and increasingly for upselling as part of marketing. Even social media are used by most organisations that I studied primarily for posting their messages, rather than listening to the conversations and comments of citizens, customers, and other stakeholders. Despite the fact that the research was open and transparent in that I told the participants that I was exploring organisational listening, the most common terms used by interviewees in discussing their day-to-day work were informing, disseminating, educating, showing, telling, and distributing. I summarised from this stage of research that most organisations listen sporadically, poorly at best, and sometimes not at all to their stakeholders and publics. It seems strange to me that today we have the skills and the technologies to listen to the universe, but we often don't listen to the most important people around us. The study concluded that in the name of public communication and related practices such as consultation and engagement, organisations create a sophisticated architecture of speaking, such as through the practices of advertising, public relations, marketing communication, promotional events, sponsorships, websites, and even social media. It recommended that organisations need to counterbalance this brutalist architecture of near non-stop speaking with an architecture of listening. Now, I propose an architecture of listening because organisational listening cannot be achieved simply by conducting the occasional listening exercise or tacking on a piece of technology, such as a social media monitoring application. The study proposed that an architecture of listening requires 8 elements. It first of all requires a culture for listening. Organisations have got to want to listen and be prepared to listen. We need to address the politics of listening, that is, who do we listen to? Because many groups, I find, are simply not regarded as worth listening to. They are marginalised and disenfranchised. Once we've addressed the culture and the politics of listening, of course, there needs to be policies for listening. There needs to be structures and processes for listening. Technologies can play a key role in listening, but not on their own. Resources also need to be applied, skills need to exist for listening, and very, very importantly, there needs to be articulation of what the organisation hears, if I can use that word, or what it receives to decision-making and policy-making. Proposing an architecture of listening to facilitate large-scale organisation public communication is not intended to be prescriptive or suggest a single solution. The overall framework of an architecture of listening not only leaves room for, but encourages creativity, innovation, and customisation. Like built architecture, there can be many forms, many styles, and infinitely varying scales. But furthermore, it is not only about creating structures, but about creating spaces. Spaces in which people can interact with organisations in mutually beneficial ways and an environment that is open and inclusive. But the story does not stop with an architecture of listening, as broad as that is. Beyond my first overall research question, which was how and how well do organisations listen, a number of additional questions then present themselves. The first of these is, what can be done? How can organisations listen and adopt a more open approach? The first conclusion I made was that organisations can improve the way they approach some of the key forms of listening, such as social and market research. For example, even today, as I'll speak about UK government, but in corporations, there's an overwhelming use of polling and quantitative research. And yet listening requires more qualitative research, for example. Public consultation increasingly is moving to digital environments, but also can occur or should occur offline as well, and I'm going to return to some of these in talking about my current research. Organisations can listen through stakeholder engagement, meetings and forums. They can listen through more open customer relations. Certainly they should listen through correspondence, inquiries and complaints. And very importantly, they can and should listen through social media listening. And I will return to a number of those in terms of how we perform. I wanted to also note, though, that as well as identifying a number of failures to listen, the Organisational Listening Project did find some exemplars and some very specialised initiatives in organisational listening. One example was the MasterCard Conversation Suite in New York. It's a multi-million dollar investment in social media listening. For example, a dedicated team of analysts in New York monitors 6,000 keywords in 26 languages across traditional and social media 24/7. In 2015, the system was identifying 36,000 traditional media articles and 3 million social media articles a year. Not only identifying them, but then prompting MasterCard executives to respond to those considered to warrant or require a response. This technology-based system is commendable in many respects, and it demonstrates what can be achieved with technology, although inevitably, of course, it has an ultimate focus on marketing MasterCard's brand and products. Behavioural Insights is an innovative approach to research and strategic planning that has been pioneered in the UK government and is now spread worldwide. The approach, which uses an iterative trialling and testing methodology to identify audience preferences and gain engagement, has been used to reduce missed medical appointments and increase blood donations in the UK. But again, I must caution that this technique, referred to colloquially as nudge marketing, can also be used for manipulative purposes as well. In addition, the study identified other potential methods of organisation listening in the literature, and I won't speak about these in detail, but everything from listening posts and citizen juries through to the appointment of ombudsmen, advisory boards, these are a number of basic ways in which organisations can open themselves up to hear and pay attention to the voices of stakeholders and publics. There's also a number of advanced and specialised initiatives that were identified in the literature, such as governments taking specific action to set up structures. For example, the National Commission for Public Debate in France, established in 1995, was a topic of a public lecture here at LSE in 2015, I think, Nick. It's a useful organisation. It's a government regulatory initiative, although there are signs that it becomes quite bureaucratic and formalised in its approach. There's also argumentation tools and argument mapping technologies being used by MIT in its Deliberatorium, an online consultation and collaboration experiment to conduct a debate on major issues such as climate change. That shows us some very advanced techniques for listening and making sense of information. Deliberative polls, which recognise the weaknesses of traditional polling, and we've seen plenty of weaknesses of traditional polling, and surveys, because they gain an off-the-top-of-the-head response to a narrow set of questions. Instead, deliberative polls explore audience views in two ways. First, by introducing the topic on which a response is sought, then allowing participants time to reflect and deliberate on the issues, even taking time to speak to families and friends, before finally recording their views. The results are very interesting because they seem to provide much more considered responses and provide deeper understanding and insights than traditional quantitative methods. Also, sense-making methodology, which I cannot go into in detail here, but which goes even further than deliberative polls to gain deeper insights into participants' views. I encourage you to read Brenda Dervin's work on sense-making methodology if you've not done so. So the point is that there are methods, from basic to advanced, and approaches through which organisations can listen more effectively at large scale, although some of these that I've mentioned are not used in the corporations or government organisations that I have visited. Also, some of these, it must be recognised, have not been tested in practice and commercial environments, and there are legitimate questions about the time required, the skills required, and the costs. Identifying these methods for improving organisational listening and discussions with colleagues, including some of the participants in the UK government, led to the next very important question and to the second stage of my project. After presenting my findings in various fora, including number 10 Downing Street, so it had no impact, it would seem, last year, the question was asked, how can we implement and test, how can we do some of these methods of organisational listening? How can we operationalise organisational listening? Thus was born the Organisational Listening Project Stage 2, in which I have been engaged here in the UK since June this year. My answer to the previous question was to propose a participatory action research project in which I and potentially other researchers work together collaboratively with a number of one or more volunteering organisations to implement some of the recommended strategies for organisational listening, and then to track the costs and time involved, the skills, tools and technologies required, and very importantly, the benefits, if they exist, that can be identified. I must acknowledge the Cabinet Office Whitehall and the UK Government, in particular, for the Government Communications Service in particular, for supporting this research, and the UK Department of Health that volunteered as a site, a guinea pig, if you like, to test and participate in the participatory action research. Also, a number of the UK's government agencies, including NHS England and Public Health England, have supported the project, and several other government departments. The cooperation that I've received in that regard means that the Organisational Listening Project Stage 2 is focused on government at this stage, whereas the first stage looked at corporations as well. However, I still hold out hope that a corporation might volunteer to open up. At this stage, we're only 6 months into implementing some of the ideas for improved organisational listening, so I cannot present conclusive or final discoveries. However, I can share with you some of the important latest findings and provide a progress report on some of the specific initiatives that are underway. I'll briefly report on 5 key areas. The first one is public consultation. And I choose this because public consultation is one of the most explicit sites in which governments purport to listen to various stakeholders and to citizens. Governments have made public consultation mandatory in many circumstances. However, this has bureaucratised and formalised the process to the extent that the current system does not serve stakeholders or citizens well in a number of cases, as I will identify. Observation that I've made from inside the planning of public consultations and analysis of consultation submissions have revealed a number of issues. The first is consultations mostly attract the usual suspects, i.e. the major organisations and elites. Many with an interest in consultation issues do not have the time, skills or the desire to write formal submissions, and there is little or no outreach conducted. For example, a public consultation on the proposed high-speed train project, HS2, attracted considerable input, as you would expect, from industry and local government authorities. But a farmer in the Midlands is unlikely to make a submission particularly online, to a consultation conducted in London, even if the proposed high-speed train is going to run through his top field. To address this, and these are some of the initiatives that are in train, a number of outreach measures are being planned, including field visits by government communication staff. In future, they will all be required to spend time in the field, an extension of community engagement to what marketers call fish where the fish are. An example that I found in North England was health workers and community outreach staff going to working men's clubs to talk about men's health issues, whereas in the past they had expected men from working class backgrounds to come to submissions, to come to formal seminars in government offices. Another problem is, it's a very basic problem, is submissions are not to public consultations are not acknowledged. A lack of acknowledgement of submissions or any inquiry or contact generally undermines trust in the process. It seems to me to be basic human nature. If we don't hear back when we contact someone, we assume that the communication has been ignored. To help address this, the Department of Health, where I've been doing work, has recently invested in an automated email system that can generate acknowledgement emails for all public submissions and inquiries and other forms of correspondence that are made to the department. It's a small step, but a very, very simple example. And, of course, you have to do much more after acknowledgement. The third thing, and probably most seriously, I've found is that submissions made to public consultations are often not analysed in detail or hardly at all, particularly when large volumes of submissions are received. And you could argue that those are precisely the times that the government should be listening most of all. For example, in 2015, the NHS mandate public consultation, which seeks views from the public, from a wide section of the community, in fact, on expectations and views of the future of the NHS, attracted 127,400 submissions, many of them up to 20 pages, more than 500,000 pages of public comment. The staff responsible did not have any tools or the skills to analyse this volume of unstructured textual data in any detail, and had to rely on manual reading and summarising. This is a classic example of why I'm concerned about organisational listening and why I talk about organisational listening being dependent on a range of systemic and institutional factors that to date have not been addressed. I'm pleased to say that in September this year, the Department of Health used Method 52, a UK-developed text analysis application that incorporates active machine learning to reanalyse the 127,400 submissions. Method 52, not that I don't particularly support that individual product, but it was developed here in the UK by university staff at the University of Sussex in partnership with Demos. It's similar to other robust text analysis systems such as Invivo, MaxQDA, and the IBM or SAP or SAS text analysis programs or open source products such as R. This in-depth analysis found seven key findings that were never discovered. It found also that several thousand of the submissions were from health professionals, many of whom had 20 years or more experience in the health system, as well as from patients reporting their experiences. Now, senior medical practitioners rarely attend focus groups, but tragically, these voices were not listened to at the time. 500,000 pages of public feedback was not processed. Not through lack of civil service dedication, I must add. It was because, as I said, lack of systems, tools, processes, and resources. Most large government departments in the UK also receive between 40,000 and 70,000 pieces of correspondence a year in the form of emails and letters. These are actually quite diligently recorded and reported on an individual basis. However, there again is no analysis of correspondence as a total data set to identify, for example, patterns, key themes, dominant issues, geolocation trends, and so forth. So in the next month or so, having done one trial with text analysis, we will be using Method 52 in a trial to analyse correspondence over the past year and possibly 3 years to the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, which will be very interesting, and the Department of Health. And I believe this may well provide further deep insights into the issues that people write about. After all, if citizens have taken the time and the trouble to write to the Prime Minister or a department, it clearly is on something that they are concerned about. Complaints are similarly dealt with individually. and I believe from what I've seen in a quite robust way. However, again, few government bodies conduct analysis of complaints over time to identify patterns, major themes, hotspots based on geographic data, and so on. To show the value of complaints analysis, two of my colleagues at LSE have analysed hospital complaints over a number of years and found that certain types of complaints about safety and quality of care, not simply the volume of complaints, are leading indicators of mortality in the subsequent year. You could say, without exaggeration, in some cases it can be established that lack of listening can cost lives. A number of NHS trusts are now using the Health Complaints Analysis Tool, HCAT. I think Alex and Tom are sitting over there that are involved in this product, and I'm very pleased that the Department of Health is considering it on wider scale, and there is also the possibility that it could be used outside of health as a more generalised tool to better analyse and understand complaints. A fourth finding from stage two of the organisational listening project, and I think it's a very big one, and it's a further example of the systemic and institutional aspects of organisational listening, is a discovery that UK government departments and agencies, which are good examples of large organisations, have terabytes and potentially petabytes of data from surveys, focus groups, consultations, as I've said, stakeholder forums, and so on. But these are used by the originating agency for their specific purposes and objectives at the time, and then stored in data silos behind firewalls and not used again. Now, I must emphasise that I'm speaking here of general research data and public feedback. Official records, such as personal medical records, clearly need to be held securely and stored and used under very strict conditions. But when stakeholders and citizens give feedback to their government in surveys, focus groups, or public consultations, I believe they expect the government as a whole to take notice and consider the information provided. However, currently there is no data centre or no knowledge management system in place in relation to social research and public feedback in the UK government, even though there have been attempts to establish this. I suspect it's the same in many large organisations. My comment is that I think that so-called big data is sort of very much like Bigfoot. It's some sort of mythical monster that we hear a lot about. We believe it's somewhere out there, but about which we know very little and usually fear it. The introduction of a knowledge management system and some form of data warehousing has now been adopted as an initiative in the UK Cabinet Office and being investigated that we can make better use of the data and share the data that we have. The fifth example that I quickly wanted to mention is systematic non-listening is that during my 2014 and 15 research, stage one as I alluded to, I found only two organisations out of 36 use social media for listening. One was the MasterCard Conversation Suite. Despite the two-way conversational nature of social media and their enormous popularity as sites of public comment and discussion, the overwhelming use of these open, interactive channels by organisations has been posting their organisational messages and marketing materials. While social media, of course, do not provide comment from representative samples, which we must bear in mind, they are an unprecedented source of fast feedback and a site to listen to the conversations of groups of people about various issues. I'm pleased to say that the Department of Health and now a number of other departments are in the participatory action research have established digital listening teams that do not post information. Their task is listening online to the conversations of the public. Hopefully this pilot will be rolled out to all government departments. There are a number of other issues that the stymie listening that I could talk about, but I'll only briefly mention this evening in the interest of time. First of all, there's a heavy focus on quantitative research, as I mentioned, particularly polling. Quantitative methods, metrics and analytics also dominate research in the commercial sector. While quantitative research is necessary, in many cases, in a number of circumstances, in-depth understanding, particularly, is more likely to come from qualitative research. So I argue that there needs to be much greater use of qualitative research, and I think had there been qualitative research leading up to June 23, we may not have had some of the polls indicating the way they did. There is also a very strong focus in government and in number 10 on campaigns. Campaigns are what the government wants to tell people. There needs to be more focus and understanding of what the people want to tell government. So I'm concerned about campaigns. And despite audience fragmentation and a decline in the influence of traditional media, there still remains a preoccupation with traditional media, the major newspapers and TV networks, and playing to the media, especially among politicians and their special advisers. The final question that arises, which I would like to conclude this evening, is really the so what question in research. Why should organisations listen more? What are the potential benefits? As part of the research project, we've reached out to studies in other disciplines, including business and management studies, political science, and research in relation to the democratic deficit, and sociological research in relation to disengagement, marginalisation, and even radicalisation. When we look around in our society, what do we see? We see declining trust in government. For example, in the United States, a recent study by Harvard found that only 14% of 14 to 29-year-old Americans trust the US Congress, and only 20% trust the federal government in general. Declining participation and disengagement in democracy. This is evidence in low voter turnouts in some areas and some demographics. Also, the membership of political parties that is a significant influence in pre-selection of politicians and also shapes party politics is declining. For example, the total membership of the three largest political parties in the UK is just 1.6% of the eligible voters in this country. Declining trust in business has been reported in successive Edelman Trust Barometer studies. We're also seeing declining employee loyalty and retention and declining customer loyalty and retention. And we're also sadly seeing radicalisation, particularly among young people in formerly mature, stable democracies. Now, identifying the benefits of improved organisational listening needs further research. But I believe studies available do indicate that more open, ethical and effective listening by organisations such as governments, corporations, could afford some significant potential benefits, including, hopefully, increased trust in business, increased participation, increased trust in business, employee loyalty retention, customer retention, certainly reduced issues and crises for governments and other types of organisations, and very importantly, a more equitable society. Now, I promised you an experiment. If you think my claims are overblown and that listening is not as important as I say, try this experiment. After you go home this evening to your families and loved ones, wives, husbands, children, etc., spend the next month talking. Talk and talk and talk and talk, and don't listen. See how those around you react and how your relationships proceed. Why should it be any different with those organisations that are meant to service? The great British physicist and philosopher Isaac Newton, who gave us understanding of gravity and has said, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants," also said, "We build too many walls and not enough bridges." Also, at a day-to-day level, I can't help but notice that when we need to resolve a problem or an issue, we always say we need to talk. But actually, listening is the greatest bridge of all. I hope that my organisational listening research can continue with the goodwill that it has received here in the UK so far, and of course the necessary funding, because I believe it can lead to significant social impact. The first stage of the report, you can download that report for free from that website. That is stage one. But of course, if you like, you can also support my superannuation fund by buying the book, which is available. Because I believe that as well as interpersonal listening, which remains critically important in our lives, effective organisational listening can afford opportunities to create understanding, insights, positive relationships, sustainable businesses, democratic legitimacy, and most importantly, more equitable societies. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim, for that fascinating and very stimulating lecture. Now I want to hand over to Sandra Jovcelovic for her response. Yes.
Thank you, Jim, for your lecture, and thank you, Nick, for inviting me to respond tonight. It is for me a great pleasure and also a privilege to be here with you discussing these issues. I feel very close to the Department of Media and Communications. In a way, it's a sibling department to my department, so it's a real pleasure to be here tonight. I think my first response to your lecture, Jim, is yes, how can I take issue with listening? It's a wonderful idea. It's a very difficult thing to take issue with. I very much agree and applaud the direction of your concerns and your research. You tackle the problem of listening conceptually and empirically at a complex level, which is the level of organizational collectives. And while your current research is more directed to government and state institutions, the conceptual and normative framework you propose is powerful enough to be used in relation to any organization, including the private and voluntary sectors. So I applaud the way in which you link up scales and levels of analysis, because this is not really an easy task, but I think you do well, and in doing so, you take us a step closer to the insight that that which matters in our personal lives is in dialogue with that which matters in our social, political lives, in our public lives. My first question to you takes a step back from the problem of listening to ask what are its conditions of possibility, okay, in our contemporary public spheres, and in particular in organizations and states operating in neoliberal public spheres of the type you have studied. Can we really build an architecture of listening in large corporations or even in state institutions where engagement and participation tend to become bureaucracies, and the logic of spin and spectacle betrays not listening, but sometimes the fear of listening to the voices of a diverse, ambivalent, and morally complex public? Or perhaps capital is the ideal listener, having nothing to defend except its own continuation and profit? You know, part of me shares your impetus for realism in conceptual definitions, so that we do not end up with concepts that are impossible to realize, totally unrealistic. So unrealistic that then it's very easy to dismiss them. Of course we can build pockets of communication. We do build pockets of communication, and I believe the most unlikely interlocutors can eventually listen to each other. But again, I wonder, can the language of PR live up to communicative listening? Can it be uncoupled from strategic, instrumental logics? Listening to communities and to individuals is part and parcel of the democratic public sphere, but it can also be a highly dangerous instrumental goal. We can all agree with you, I think, that listening is above all a practice of communication, of an intersubjective, transactional exchange between parties, and I think that was very much the theoretical framework that guided your presentation, your architecture of listening, as it guides the toolkit that my colleagues developed. That's something that Alex Gillespie and Tom Reeder have discussed extensively in developing a toolkit for organizational listening. But how we are listening is the crux of the problem. So here's what I want to suggest to you. Good listening, framed by intersubjective communication, also requires a consideration of the positioning of the listener, of what the listener is actually up to in the listening process. What is going on with the listener? At which point in the listening process is his or her orientation challenged? Okay, in communicative listening, we need to be prepared to become less of ourselves and more something that transforms what we are as we engage with others, so that the position, the perspective, and the orientation of the other is allowed to take center stage. We can think about this in extremes, okay? One extreme is listening for communication, and we find it in the almost mystical psychology of Buber and Levinas, for instance, in their think about the other orientation in their psychologies, okay? We also find it more mundanely, but not less profoundly, you know, in early human ontogeny, when we study the relationship, primary forms of intersubjectivity between caretakers and infants, for instance. Human caretakers can listen to their babies with a profound and emotional orientation, even if they don't have the benefit of a spoken language. And I think it's important to get back to this primordial relationship, because it's a first expressive of the human capacity for deep communication, and second, because it helps us to understand that asymmetry in power does not necessarily lead to domination. The way we can do that with our babies reminds us of our capacity for domination. But at the other extreme of listening, we find listening as surveillance, as a kind of Foucauldian nightmare, where everyone and every technology is listening, where the self is always exposed and its right to privacy, even its right to remain silent, is not there, is undermined. And I would not mention here the internet or Google or, you know, the CIA, or organizations that listen. Okay, so here listening becomes a spying, finding out the truth of the other so that the other can be dealt with to the point of being crushed and even destroyed. You find this extreme form of listening in Cortés and his conquest of the Americas. Cortés was a very skilled listener who engaged deeply with the local indigenous peoples he met in the Americas, so that he was able to understand them and eventually conquer them. In Cortés' conquest of the Americas, we find this paradox of listening for understanding and then for killing. So here I'm obviously referring to the seminal work of Todorov and his analysis of colonization. So between these two extremes, no doubt we found multiple, very diverse, nuanced variations of listening. And perhaps these extremes inhabit, they express a tension that will not go away, because they are part of what we are as individuals, and they are part of our public spheres as well. I think Freud certainly thought so, and he saw these two tendencies as inhabiting the human mind, inhabiting the human heart. He believed that the only way we can contain the Cortés, the conquering listeners of this world, is actually building institutions and a symbolic order based on the right as the might of a community. But today, as institutions and the symbolic order seem to be out of joint, as organizations and politicians listen and play with the sorrows and excessive frustrations of those voices who have been for perhaps too long forgotten, how can we possibly hope to guarantee the human bias towards the loving attitude of the listening caretaker, as opposed to the conquering orientation of Cortés in our social, political, and economic spheres? I somehow stand here as a Habermasian psychologist, looking and hoping for evidence that this new buzz of engagement and dialogue is something to believe in, rather than being just, as Habermas predicted, instrumental action colonizing communicative action. So Jim convinced me that organizations can listen, and they are not listening to conquer. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sandra. Now our second respondent is Stephen Coleman from Leeds University.
Thank you, Jim. I listened with growing admiration. Great project. We want more of it. Your subject could not be more politically timely, for we're living through what increasingly feels like an insurgency of the unheard. For most of my lifetime, it's been complacently assumed that the unheard would simply fade away. That's not always the verb that was used. Into sullen silence, interrupted by occasional bouts of vulgar pique and localized self-harm. Leave them alone, exclude them from polling models because they won't vote, humour their audacious resentments, and tell them what's best for them, from how to bring up their kids to how to speak. Perhaps pay occasional rhetorical service to the value of listening to them, failing ever to acknowledge the unbridgeable chasm between simulated attention and sensitive comprehension. But the attention economy, like every other aspect of the global economic order, is profoundly unequal. It's structurally unequal. Who listens to whom, on whose terms, and with what consequences are socially determined and deeply ingrained. Codes of recognition depend upon the regular misrecognition of certain voices. Inattention is not a random act of disrespect, but it is deeply embedded within a system of political representation which regards democracy as a politically bounded notion, relating to the election and accountability of responsible representatives, but not to the terms of cultural worth. Political democracy, as we've come to experience it in the West, is characterized by a parsimonious code that values all voices equally for one brief plebiscitary moment every few years, and the rest of the time accommodates itself to the cultural hierarchies and inequalities which are self-replicating, underpinning a deeply undemocratic social order. When Walter Bagehot, the most prominent theorist of the English Constitution, wrote of the newly enfranchised male public in the 1860s that, I quote, "notwithstanding their numbers, they must always be subject, always at least be comparatively uninfluential. Whatever their capacity may be, it must be less than that of the higher classes whose occupations are more instructive and whose education is more prolonged." He was articulating an orthodoxy that was to define and degrade the liberal democratic project for the next century and a half. At the heart of this skewed political perspective is a characterization of the non-elite as the masses, those people whose presence must be acknowledged but rarely respected. The masses are the demos degraded through the lens of condescension. As Raymond Williams once put it, "I do not think of my relatives, friends, neighbours, colleagues, acquaintances as masses. We none of us can or do. The masses are always the others, whom we don't know and can't know." So here, I think, lies a disconnection that is at the core of the non-listening political culture that Jim has so well described. How do you recognise voices that seem to be inherently unintelligible, vulnerable, vulgar, and peripheral? Well, political elites have resorted to three compensatory strategies. The first I call technologies of knowing without listening, of which opinion polling is, of course, the most pernicious exemplar. As one leading scholar from the British Election Study put it, when she was sharing a platform with me after the 2015 election. I quote, "Our methods allow us to know what voters think better than they know it themselves," unquote. The second compensatory mechanism are token exercises in listening. Jim's spoken very well about them. Consultations that are completely decoupled from decision-making. Talking exercises geared to catharsis rather than efficacy. And consequences are the important thing. That's why the usual suspects engage in consultations, because it's the usual suspects, the rich and educated, who tend to get their way. And everybody else refuses to participate because they don't. The third compensatory tactic is cultural disdain, the preferred method of post-truth politicians for whom listening to the public means listening to echoes of their own prejudices. And this, for them, serves as a way of avoiding cognitive dissonance, avoiding having to deal with the realities that surround them. They, of course, are the masters now. Or they are the masters for now. When politicians and civil servants fail to listen or to hear the voices of millions of people expressing experiences that have been rendered institutionally unknowable, this is not a random error. It's not a mistake. It's not something they've forgotten to do. It reflects a particular conception of democracy, an institutionalized, insular, and often insulting conception, but one that is so deeply embedded that I do not believe it can simply be dealt with by the kind of good intentions that Jim is attempting to promote. I'm completely with Jim regarding the democratic value of listening as a political practice. Let's have more listening, better listening, full civil servants to go on summer retreats where they're made to listen. All lovely. I'll run them. But I think that more needs to be said about the object of democratic listening. What is it that we're listening to? And there are two ways of thinking about this object that are bound to be unfruitful. Firstly, listening is a process of calculable aggregation, as if the counting of randomized preferences could ever reflect the nuances and intensities of public voice. So all listening that leads to bland statements like the public thinks, the public wants, the public feels, are probably profoundly dangerous. Secondly, listening to atomized voices, complaints, suggestions, testimonies, invariably reflecting the disparate capabilities of those who have the time and confidence to complain, suggest, and testify. In fact, we over-listen to certain voices, and democracy demands a capacity to resist the entitled claims-making of the disproportionately heard. We should stop listening to them. I want to suggest that we think, therefore, about the object of listening in a rather different way. Cultures are constellations of stories in circulation. We attach ourselves to stories that make sense of reality. As a great sociologist of medical narrative, Arthur Frank, has put it, I quote, "Good stories make one point of view paramount. Other subjectivities are disregarded. People caught up in those stories forget what the story means to those who are the objects of action taken from the perspective that the story encourages. A good life requires telling any story from as many alternative perspectives as possible and recognizing how all the characters are trying to hold their own." And this holding their own is, I think, something that's deeply important, and I think Sandra touched on it. I'm just completing a book about the experience of political talk, what people remember, think, fear, and like about political talking. And in it, I developed this argument further about how people attach themselves and detach themselves from stories. But I want to conclude by summarizing some of what I am arguing in that book in the words of the American poet Adrian Rich, whose response to the pathology of listening that Jim has so well described and the catastrophe of populism from which we are all now reeling was this. When someone with the authority of a teacher, say, describes the world and you are not in it, there is a moment of psychic disequilibrium, as if you looked into a mirror and saw nothing. Yet you know you exist and others like you. That is a game done with mirrors. It takes some strength of soul, and not just individual strength, but collective understanding, to resist this void and to stand up, demanding to be seen and heard. I think that demand is most likely to be realised not by well-influenced civil servants, but by the public itself.
Thank you very much, both respondents, for terrific responses and engaging with Jim's talk. Jim, do you want to say something very brief and condensed? Because we want to open up to questions, but there was so much to engage in there. I'm sure you have something brief to say, and then I'm sure you can come back.
I'll be very brief because you want to ask some questions, but probably just 2 points that I could pick up. I thank you both for the comments, and I don't have any real issue with them. I think they're all great points. But just very briefly, the surveillance issue that Sandra referred to really does concern me, because listening can be used for different purposes. And in the book, I very clearly up front make a statement that surveillance listening, it comes under, it's the most extreme form of what I call instrumental listening. We are only listening to derive benefits for oneself. And surveillance is the most cynical form of that. So I'm very mindful of that and totally agree with those points. But in general, the listening that does occur is largely all instrumental. Sometimes it's as cynical as surveillance, but often it's still to work out how to target you, how to get you to do something the organisation wants, or how to get away with something and that you don't notice. So that's a very legitimate point. The other quick point I'd comment on in Stephen's overall comment that he expressed so eloquently is, yes, I share a lot of cynicism and scepticism about what I'm researching. I'm very, very mindful of Habermas's sort of disillusionment in the public sphere, and that so many aspects have failed already. The mass media never lived up to their expectations, and now social media is not as well. I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about the very deep-seated orthodoxy that Stephen talked about. You know, why would anyone ever change the system when it's benefiting those who are in power? The key thing that I am trying to pursue is the benefits angle. And the reason I'm doing participatory action research is that I think I'll fail, and none of this will ever happen unless we can show there are benefits not only to you and I, but benefits to those in power. And the time may be right to do that, because what Brexit was a rising up of the insurgency of the unheard. Unless we take the vote off people, maybe that'll happen, I don't know, but unless we take the vote off people, there's still going to be one way of speaking that they have. And what's been happening around the world, in the US and in Brexit and in my country, Australia, where the government holds one seat majority, is that people are using the vote to speak very, very loudly. And it's unsettling governments, it's destroying governments, and I think that they have to respond to the people. And I think that radicalisation is another example, not just the extreme Muslim radicalisation, but the number of people are stepping outside of our democratic system and pursuing other means. So I think I have faith in the people. And I think that there are benefits to us, but I think there are benefits to those in power, because they do not want instability, they do not want revolution, they do not want to be thrown out of office. And maybe we can use those desire for those benefits to extract a little bit of progress, perhaps. But I am not naive.
Thank you, Jim. Let's take some questions. First of all, was the gentleman over there, I saw, and then I'll come back over here. Perhaps I'll take two in pairs, I think. So you go to you next. Yeah.
John Strafford. Professor, I totally agree with your last comments, and I put it to you that politics, political parties, are tribal, and the tribe likes to have a strong leader, but the tribe also likes to be listened to before the leader takes a decision. And that worked extremely well after the Second World War, when there was maximum participation in politics and the age of deference. But that age of deference is now gone. And now people want participation. And if they don't get it, they become wholly and totally disillusioned, which is why we've seen the decline in membership of the political parties. But how do you reconcile the strong leader aspect with the participation aspect? Because if they can't participate, and if the leader doesn't listen to them, the leader becomes a dictator rather than a leader. So it's the reconciliation of those elements that is essential. And I totally agree with you. I think that where you see in the Labour Party now with Corbyn and the increase of membership, those people are joining because they believe they're going to have a say in the running of the party. Equally, in the United States, they think that Trump is going to listen to them. So these great changes are happening.
Thank you very much. I'll take one other question right here, the gentleman in the grey T-shirt, and then we'll take another pair in a moment.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk. I thought it was very informative. I wonder what you thought about the role that fear plays in not listening. You spoke about the organisational deafness stemming from mostly quantitative, not qualitative methods of trying to listen, and also about campaigns of prescription and not reception, so instrumentalising technologies that could be used for listening rather than using them for merely kind of imposing an ideology and mediatization. And I wondered if in your research you found or you identified or might observe something prior to those objects that would drive those organizations to use those objects in that way. I wondered if perhaps fear might play some role in that.
Thank you very much. Jim, do you want to respond to those two?
I might do the second one first because it's fresh in my mind. Yes, there is a huge fear of listening in organisations, and in government and in corporations, I found it, that they regularly said things like, but if we start listening openly the way you say, it's going to open a Pandora's box. I heard that phrase a lot. We're going to get expected to do everything. We'll have to comply. It'll be chaos. There's no evidence of that. And in fact, in the few occasions when you do go out to talk to people, is they actually have, sadly, very low expectations. And when you do talk to people, often they'll say things like, well, I know they probably can't do it, but what they do demand is acknowledgement and recognition. Absolutely minimum price of entry is acknowledgement and recognition, and we're not giving that. Surprising, and we're not reporting back very well either. That's another issue. So I think that the evidence so far, there is no evidence that people are unrealistic. You do get a lot of chaos and a lot of, I think consensus is a myth. Listening is hard. I never said it's easy. It's really quite difficult. But I don't think it opens a Pandora's box. I think people's expectations right now are lower than ever. And the fear is unfounded. I mean, if organisations increase their listening by 5%, it might be quite dramatic. The leader participation is a really good point. Because when I talk to politicians, and I didn't address them in the study, but I did actually interview a lot of politicians, they do raise the issue that they're elected and they're meant to be leaders, but at the same time they've got to participate. And I puzzled over this, and I talked to some management scholars who work with leadership, and I think the answer lies somewhere in the fact that those things do not have to necessarily be in opposition. There is a time to be a leader. But there's different forms of leadership, and there are books from Nordhaus and others on leadership. And if you're sort of an autocratic leader that does no prior consultation and no homework, it's not a very good model of leadership. But today, leadership studies talk about emotional intelligence, empathy, consultation, by all means making decisions and doing things, but good leaders have done a lot of vibing into their audiences, a lot of homework, a lot of empathy, applied a lot of emotional intelligence in advance. So what I'm finding, and I'm not a management or leadership scholar, but what I'm finding in that literature says that the right kind of leader, the kind of leader that's now put forward as the best example, consultation and listening is not an anathema to good leadership.
Okay, I think there were two questions there. There's a gentleman in the white shirt, and then I saw Anne Lapping, I think, at the back. I can see her. And then there's another one. Let's take three together now. You first, sir.
Okay. Long ago, I had a horrible job doing survey interviews for NOP market research. I remember the team leader said, if you get anybody who's unemployed, on benefits, disabled, on a low income, basically in groups D and E, get them off the phone as fast as you can, because, you know, it's pointless talking to them. Then they're not going to buy anything, basically. Now, 30 years later, those same groups have more or less, in a sense, self-exclude from voting. The voting rates in those old categories for D and E is about half that for A and B, roughly speaking. Don't you find it fascinating that in public discourse, right across the media, whereas other low voting groups, defined in various ways, are often addressed, that discrepancy in voting never is. That group is defined as an out-group, a problem group for the rest of us. Even in discourse here, one tends to talk about, well, there are those in power and then there are us, the sort of well-educated, fairly well-off, and we're going to solve this. And this other lot, the D&E group, are still, they just fall off the agenda. That's one point. Just on leadership, well, there is the interpretation of leadership that it's to interpret what people want and redirect it in a more coherent way. But
thank you very much. Let's go to Anne Lapping at the back there.
Yes. Thank you. I thought that was an amazingly rich picture, an amazingly rich explanation or examination you gave us about listening. And it went from the highly theoretical to the very practical. And for the moment, and I think you're absolutely right about the timing, we are now facing a crisis of democracy. And some people are looking to the internet and saying that is a way of garnering the information and knowledge about what people really want that we're all beating our breasts about having been ignoring. But I would like for a moment just to take up the government and rather practical rather than theoretical points that you've been making. If you are in government, if you are in a government department, you are getting a whole lot of information. Now, I'm sure lots of people would say here it comes from select committees, it comes from organized lobby groups, and that, of course, is true. But if you put yourself in the place of the civil servant or the civil service, garnering, listening, advertising for information about, I don't know, and listening to complaints about, say, the pension system, what do you do with all that information? How do you categorize it, whatever technical method you may have for picking out words that come most often? Aren't you in danger of arousing expectations, which it is not because it's the ruling class manipulating, but because it's almost impossible to deal with? And the big issues, government and government departments are almost bound to be hearing suggestions, complaints about fairly technical things, to stick with the pensions example. Whereas underlying what people have been referring to is not dissatisfaction about those kind of things. It's dissatisfaction about much bigger societal failures or changes.
Thank you very much. I just want to take one other question from Anna there, who's, and then Jim, and maybe Stephen and Sandra can come back on those great points. Anna.
Thank you. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on the sort of the where of listening, how you might need to sort of move your ear around to be able to hear different things or to be able to pick up certain sounds. And I'm thinking about the both sort of the actual geography of a country, if we think of governments, but also of sort of the political geography, the structure, and also the media landscape. And then, so not just in terms of what you're listening to or which channels come to you, which pause or which other channels that you listen to, but if you need to maybe move around a bit, and if you whether you have any interview results on the willingness to move your ear around a bit.
Okay, thank you.
There's a lot there. The first one talked about, segmentation, our ABs, CDs. That's very popular work in marketing. I touched very, very briefly on sense-making methodology, and I'm not sure if many of you have read about it. It's fairly recent approach to methodology, and I didn't have time to go into it. I really suggest you have a look at it because it changed some of my views. Sense-making methodology is a totally different approach to research, not just making sense of research. And one of the fundamental principles going into it is the organisation needs to be prepared to change, that recognising there's an equal chance that the organisation may have to change something as the audience may have to change something. That usually stops most organisations in their tracks and they don't go any further. But it also totally rejects the approach of segmentation and of putting people in buckets or categories. What it says is that may have worked in a undereducated age, an industrial age, but it talks about that today people are, what it says, is mobile, they move through space and time, and that examples like an 18-year-old unemployed male would be put typically into E, C or D or E, but they say he or she may be ambitious and aspirational and may have the same attitudes as a business person, whereas somebody who's highly affluent today may actually be having second thoughts about capitalism, be a radical campaigner for environmentalism. And they're saying that this whole segmentation structure that marketing uses is outdated, and it actually pre-categorizes people into buckets and then allocates meanings and attitudes to them that are not right, and that people will move on different issues across different opinions. So I just commend sense-making methodology to you because I think it's anti-sense, it's anti-that. The other quick point there is I'm kind of refreshed a little bit and given mild hope by the movements that are happening in our society that are mobilising CDEs, if we use that old language. There's a whole lot of community groups, a lot of collaborative grassroots type organisations, and there are organisations out there working with them. And I find that really, really interesting. I've worked with groups like Community Organisers, co.com or co.uk, Fixers, and groups like this that are going out and actually working with and helping those groups that haven't got a voice to become more powerful and more influential, and teaching them some of the techniques. So I find that that's rattling the cage a little bit of the establishment. The final question talked about where do you listen. I mentioned outreach only very briefly, and it's really, really important because when I looked at some of the consultations, they sat passively and waited for people to speak to them. Now, the people who will speak to government or big corporations are going to be the highly literate, highly educated, etc. I was appalled to be sitting in the planning of a consultation being done on the Green Paper for Disability that's currently happening right now. And they went through the list of organisations they were going to talk to, and I finally had to ask, is anyone actually going to talk to someone with a disability, or a different ability, if you use that term? That hadn't occurred to them. We were talking to all the various charities and organisations, and it's like, get on your bike, wear some shoe leather out, and go out. I don't like quoting advertising, but David Ogilvy, famous advertising guru, said this in the context of the United States. If you want to understand Americans, get on a bus and go to Iowa. Now, you could write that same script, and I think you might be saying North England, Scotland, etc., Leeds, Coventry, whatever, getting out and going there and talking to real people. So there's a real London bubble, and listening, yes, you've got to proactively go out. I'm all for representative samples and averaging, but there are times to do purposive sampling. The disability is one example. Going out and speaking to specific people who you know may be marginalised, who've not had a voice, and making it easy for them, talking on their terms. I remember doing a consultation where they took the text analysis took all the swearing words out, including F words, and it was about the economy. I thought that was a really good description of the economy, actually. But,
Thank you,
Jim. Did you guys want to add? Stephen, I've missed a lot, Sandra, I know. But
do you want to comment on those, any of those points, or any?
I think you're quite right about the D's and the E's. I mean, that was what was wrong with all of the polling models before the referendum. 3 million people voted in that referendum whose responses to opinion polls, if they gave any responses, would have been thrown away. I know that because I've done it myself in the past. The traditional voting model that any of the leading polling organisations in this country uses, throws away data that is received from people who are unlikely to vote. And the assumption was they wouldn't vote. They did vote. They changed the result of the referendum. Exactly the same thing happened. I've got absolutely no doubt that the explanation for the Trump victory is demographic. People voted who hadn't voted in previous American elections and changed the result. So that's where we've got to be looking. We've got to be looking at the reality that people are now using the vote in rather different ways. I think my second point is I want to just go back to, and I'd quite like Jim perhaps to say something about, this point about stories. I think stories are incredibly important. Stories are circulating. And when we talk about managing expectations, well, of course, who sets the expectations? Where do the expectations come from? Expectations don't just come out of thin air. Governments set expectations, but the mass media set expectations. So that stories have a disparate life. They have a very unequal existence. Some stories get taken up. Some stories really have to struggle to be taken up. Now, what seems to happen is we're in a period of kind of narrative turbulence where what are called the elites or the establishment have lost control of the narrative. But we are also in a period where nobody does have control of the narrative, and the people who are influencing the narrative don't seek to control it. They are simply influencing it. It is an uncoordinated effect on the narrative.
Thank you. Sandra, if you have something urgent, or I can bring in two more questions. Okay, I want to bring in the two questions over there, please. The gentleman, yes, the lady first, and then the gentleman.
This is a question for...
The mic's just coming for you, don't worry.
Thank you. This is a question for Professor McNamara. I still don't understand. You said in your architecture of listening, you mentioned effective organization and listening can be done for technologies, using the technologies for listening, A. And then you said social media listening is fast feedback, it's two-way, etc. Can I bring in the example of the government in Holland, where the ombudsman in Holland says, I only see people who are so enraged every day because they feel they have nowhere to go with their complaints. No one listens. Everything is go online. You phone up and it's go online. The first message through the phone. You write and it's go online. And they gave the example in Holland that four or five terms of right-wing governments have abdicated every of their responsibilities by privatizing almost every government service, prisons, schools, hospitals, you name it. And these organizations do not take accountability. They don't take on their responsibilities. How then are you going to use the technology? Because the danger in Holland is that next year the government is introducing no paper offices. Everything will be done by email.
Thank you. Wonderful point. And then a final question from the gentleman in the front.
Again, thank you so much for a fantastic talk. My main thing I want to say is basically, yes, it's important to listen, but I think what a lot of the times we're missing is why are we listening? What are the goals for listening, especially when it comes to governance in general? I see it, if I may use the analogy, as a train driver being asked to drive an off-road vehicle and he has never driven before. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim, your final response.
Yes, I'll be brief. And thank you for the clarifying on technologies. Everything you said is I agree with. I think, hopefully say that technologies are not the solution on their own. There is a tendency to, in government and in elsewhere, to use social media, online consultations moving online. In fact, the UK government's got a huge policy of digitalisation of nearly everything, and it's done for cost reasons. And what I was trying to say in the architecture of listening is that technologies are part of the solution, but I put them down in about fifth place because you've got to have a culture, you need the resources, you need the skills, you need the policies, and you've got to be prepared to articulate what you learn into if you don't do all those other things. And I'm very concerned about consultation being taken online because already that's going to exclude a lot of people. Social listening, as I said, it's not a representative sample. Often it's a skewed sample, but it's one of the methods. And usually an architecture suggests that there's a number of models and tools that you would use. So I agree with you. Why listen? Look, I think it does go back to some of the fundamental issues that Stephen and Sandra were alluding to in that, you know, we chose a democracy. And why did we choose a democracy? And if we wanted to live in a, you know, autocratic state with a dictator, that's one thing. But in a democracy, it's based on the fact that there will be a degree of listening to people. Governments benefit from that because they gain legitimacy in a democracy out of listening, at least to some extent, and reflecting what the citizens want. If governments don't do that, I think in any state, democratic or other, they will lead to instability, unrest, radicalization, and possibly even, in a Marxist view, outright revolution. So I think that governments have got to listen ultimately because there will be a cost. Elites will always try and lead, but elites can only remain elites with a certain degree of permission of the society they operate in. So that I think there's some level. I would like much more self-regulating force, but I'm not a sociologist. I don't know the answers, but I think there is some self-regulating force, and the instability in Australian politics, US politics and UK politics is a sign that the current systems aren't working. The political parties are completely out of touch. I'm not even sure we need political parties other than as administrative systems because they represent 1.6% of the people. And politicians are starting to realise that. They're listening to their parties a lot. Would you listen to the Conservative Party that represents 0.4% of the UK voters?
On that note, Jim has raised questions which really go to the very heart of the legitimacy of the democratic system, so we have to thank him, and the profound responses also from Sandra and Stephen. Thank you all very much, and join us for drinks.